Across my years in ministry, I have noticed that the days and weeks following national elections are times when people need a little extra pastoral care. There are always those who are excited and jubilant and want to celebrate, and of course, there are always those on the losing end of things who are troubled and forlorn. I've always tried my best to be pastor to both groups over the years, regardless of my own joy or dismay in the moment. It's long been my belief, rooted in the promises of the gospel, that in the end, no matter who controls the White House or the Congress or the state legislature, we're always in God's good hands, and that in all things, God is working for good. My post-election counsel has also been rooted in a pragmatic consideration, and that was the simple fact that in my own experience, those I voted for never turned out to be quite as good as I had hoped, and those I voted against seldom turned out to be quite as bad as I had feared. I hope that's going to be true in the years ahead. These last 2 weeks, though, the pastoral conversations have been different in tenor. Perhaps because of the shrill and strident tones of campaigns all around, full of racial animus, and maybe because of the open and unmuffled threats to whole groups of people, there's still so much anxiety and fear as the votes continue to be totaled. It's not so much personal fear that people have expressed to me, for indeed many of us here are sufficiently privileged to be able to survive changes of congressional leadership. It's rather a fear in behalf of those who are especially vulnerable, or fear of actions that might cause great harm, or fear of what governance or lack thereof will look like. In the wake of such expressed fears, I was reminded this week of a troubling but compelling commentary I heard some years ago on NPR's series called This I Believe. Maybe you remember it. People from all walks of life submitted short credos for that series, brief statements of their own truth that they held close. Most of them were positively framed. I believe in the strength of community. I believe in resilience, that sort of thing. But one disturbing credo was offered by a Chinese immigrant to this country, and it caught me off guard. He began, "I believe in a potential for brutality." The writer was Yanan Yong Zhu, who came to this country from Shanghai when he was 16 years old. He now holds a doctorate from Harvard and specializes in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. He said, "When I was six, in the streets of Shanghai near the end of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, I watched a parade of trucks carrying political dissidents on their way to be publicly executed. At the front of each truck was a young man roped from head to toe, wearing a sign that read, 'Counter-Revolutionary.' If not for that," he said, "you would have had trouble guessing what the event was. There was an air of festivity there. Thousands of bystanders were laughing and talking. It was like a traditional Chinese New Year celebration, except what the city was celebrating that day was its own brutality." "I believe we're brutal," he said, "because innocence can be corrupted, like mine was as a six-year-old in a time of revolution. When I entered the first grade, I started to wave flags and denounce the politically fallen of the day and shout, 'Death to the counter-revolutionaries.' My friends and I didn't want to miss any of the meetings where political dissidents were publicly tortured or humiliated. There was entertainment in it for us." "I believe brutality is a disease," he said, "just like cancer. Each and every one of us is at risk, including me. When our better instincts are suppressed, isn't that the beginning of brutality?" "I was fortunate," he said. "I was too young to be a Red Guard, where my brutality would have been codified." but I had a grandmother who showed me the value of kindness. I wish we could learn to prevent hatred and brutality from forming. I teach my children that hitting is not allowed, period. I encourage them to be compassionate, to be of aid to those in need, and to stand up for the weak. And most of all, I try to be vigilant about the purity of my motives and cautious about my actions, because I believe I must guard against my own potential for brutality and the mutation of my own humanity. As I listened in recent days to people expressing their fears and read numerous reports of verbal and physical assaults on racial and religious minorities in the days around the election, I thought of Yunong Yongzhu. I confess that I do worry about what some of my friends might be facing in the months ahead, maybe at the hands of the government, but more likely at the hands of some of the hate groups now invited back into the mainstream of American life. Yunong Yongzhu was right, I think. It's so important to teach kindness to our children and guard against the mutation of our humanity. Or as we in the Christian community would say it, it's important for us to be the church, to lean into Christ's self-giving love, to labor for justice and equity, for the embrace of immigrants and sojourners in our midst, for kindness and compassion toward all we meet, including those who see the world differently, who vote differently, and who think differently than we do. Ultimately, being the church, being Christian in our time, is about much more than any election. The struggle for light amid darkness, the struggle against the diminishing of our humanity, is not or not only a political struggle, but it is a more cosmic battle. As Paul said to the Ephesians, our struggle is not with flesh and blood, but against the rulers, the authorities, against the cosmic forces of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. It's against such principalities and powers that Paul invites the Christian community to put on the whole armor of God. It's for such a struggle that we're called to be the church, to do justice, to love kindness, to hate evil, and to hold fast to what is good, to rejoice in hope, to be steadfast in prayer, to be the church, guarding against the diminishing of our humanity, and indeed reaching out to those who are vulnerable and under assault, standing with all those and for all those who find themselves discounted or discarded. Of all the tasks of Christian faithfulness, perhaps none is more important to embrace today than the trait of compassion. Compassion means literally to suffer with. It's a learned behavior. It's a honed instinct. It's born and nurtured in relationship. Says one Christian teacher, the call to compassion is not about somebody doing for someone else. Rather, its value is in the relationship in which everyone is changed. The Hebrew prophets say that we find our own good in seeking the common good. The prophet Isaiah says that when we feed the hungry, take in the homeless, break the yoke of oppression, we find our own healing. He also says the act of compassion requires that you hide not yourself from your own flesh. In other words, compassion means recognizing the kindred spirit we all share together. Compassion goes beyond random acts of kindness. It takes kindness beyond sympathy to empathy, to the embrace of another's pain or distress. It's a virtue especially important in this post-election time when feelings and emotions are still a bit raw, but it's also a timely virtue for every single day. We who have known God's love and hospitality and compassion need to remember who and whose we are, and in such memory, remember our calling to demonstrate such love and hospitality and compassion to everyone, not just to some. Remember your baptism, people of faith. Remember your calling. Remember your compassion. I'm haunted by Yunong Yong Zhu and his memory of the festive crowds in Shanghai gathered for summary executions, troubled by his residual belief in our potential for brutality. But there are other stories to tell, and so I want to share with you a counter story, a true story told several years ago by the poet Naomi Shihab Nye, who grew up as the child of a Palestinian father and an American mother. In a post that went viral on social media, she told of one night in an airport in New Mexico. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal after learning my flight had been delayed for 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of gate A4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately, the voice said. Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate, and so I went there. I found an older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, crumpled to the floor, wailing loudly. Help, said the flight service person. Talk to her. I don't know what her problem is. We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this. So I stooped to put my arm around the woman, and I spoke to her haltingly in Arabic. The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso the next day for a major medical treatment. I said, no, we're fine. You'll get there just later. Who's picking you up? Let's call him. And so we called her son, and I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane, and I would ride next to her. It was Southwest Airlines. She talked to him, and then we called her other sons just for the fun of it. And then we called my dad, and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, that they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? And this all took about 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling about her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She'd pulled a sack of homemade mamul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, out of her bag and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not one woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There is no better cooking. And then the airline broke out free beverages from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving us all apple juice, and they were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. And I thought, such an old country tradition, always carry a plant, always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other people too. This can still happen anywhere, she said. Not everything is lost. I think she's right. Isn't that the world we all want to live in? And we can if we let go of our disdain for those who are different and embrace simple compassion, that capacity to see the other as one sees oneself, recognizing our common humanity, and reaching out to the other's hunger and pain and fear. For us, the Church, we can embrace Christian compassion, which is the capacity to see one's own face mirrored in the face of another, and to recognize there, on closer examination, the very face of Christ. Part of embodying such compassion in our time is recognizing that we need each other. All of us. We need each other. If we're to live faithfully in these days, we will not do so alone. We need each other, young and old, rich, poor, gay and straight, Christian, Muslim, Jew, Republicans, Democrats, and all those who eschew such labels. We need each other. Paul was talking to the community of saints in Corinth, but he might as well have been talking to all of us when he told that deeply divided congregation that they were one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, "I have no need of you," he said. No. We need each other. We're all in this together. So be kind, be compassionate. You may not change those who stand against you, but if you remember to be the Church, then they will not, in the end, change you. And who knows? Maybe there'll be cookies.